On behalf of the panel, welcome to the Court of Appeals this morning, July 10th, 2019. Marshall, could you call our first case for us?
Yes, calling case A180990, in re the custody of NSB LJB ETV, Terry Ann Bischoff, appellant versus Linda J. Better, respondent.
Thank you. Counsel, you're well acquainted with our procedures. Please remember to announce your appearance when you commence your argument in chief and adjust the podium as you wish to be comfortable with it, and keep an eye on the time for us. Counsel for appellant.
Understood, Your Honors. Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jack DeWalt, D-E-W-A-L-T. Good morning, Counsel, Mr. Deebly. I'm appearing today on behalf of appellant Ms. Terry Ann Bischoff, and there are three questions before the court in this case, Your Honors. One, did the district court err when it denied appellant standing to proceed as a legal parent under Chapter 257? Two, did the district court err when it found Minnesota's Parentage Act constitutional after denying appellant standing? And three, did the district court err when it denied appellant standing as a third-party custodian? The answer to all three questions, Your Honor, should be answered in the affirmative that yes, in fact, the district court did err in its rulings. Considering the first question, Your Honors, the district court committed clear error by failing to apply a plain reading of the statutory language contained within Chapter 257. It failed to do so in a general sense under the chapter as a whole, and also in a specific sense under statute section 257.71, and failed to apply the facts at hand to that statutory provision. That provision, Your Honors, is titled an action to declare a mother and child relationship, and it provides in relevant part that a woman alleged or alleging herself to be the mother of a child may bring an action to determine the existence or non-existence of a mother and child relationship. The statute goes on to reference various provisions of the Parentage Act, which include Minnesota's holding out provision, which is requires a factual finding that a party seeking standing as a parent by virtue of holding themselves out must have established by the facts that they held themselves out as a parent of a child during their minority, which appellant has done. Just to give the court a few of the undisputed facts that are in the record demonstrating how appellant did that, was that when the children were born, all three children, she was the first person to hold the children. She was the individual who presented all three children to both sets of the families in the hospital during the births. The baptismal announcement for the youngest children identified both parties as parents. All three children have names of the appellant's family members incorporated into their names. All three children have godparents from each party's family. All three children were baptized in the Moravian Church, which is the church appellant was raised in. And appellant was a stay-at-home parent during the children's minority.
Could I just stop you? Because I think we have a lot of statutes to discuss here, because I think you make a really compelling case factually.
Thank you, Your Honor.
On this, I think the issue is what do the statutes provide here, and with regard to the use of the presumptions, I mean, which presumption are you? I think you're only looking at the holding out presumption. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. There is no dispute that there is not a biological connection between my client and the children. So the presumption that would be coming into play would be within chapter section 257.55 contains the holding out presumption.
But when we look at that presumption, it's the language of the statute is that, first of all, the statute refers to a man and father throughout the whole statute. And it also indicates that the holding out is holding out as the biological father. I mean, how would that apply here because I don't think there's any dispute that your client is not the biological mother, correct?
No. And as I've already conceded to the court, that is not the case. There is no dispute that my client is not the biological parent. But in fact, the Parentage Act as a whole includes presumptions that are not tied to biology. And to answer the question of the court, I would actually direct the court to another section. There are a lot of statutes in this case, 257.54, subpart A, which identifies that a mother can be established both through proof of biology and by giving birth, as well as the other sections of the Parentage Act. And there's an or that is used, not an and, to allow an individual to establish legal parentage. And I would also identify that within the case law dealing with this, if you...
Isn't that usually through adoption or a proceeding? I mean, because you can't, I mean, I don't read any of these statutes. It's just saying by virtue of the fact you live with someone and act like a parent to the children, that in and of itself is sufficient to establish paternity or maternity.
It requires a holding out of yourself as the parent. And I think that is where the line gets drawn between the questions of, well, what if somebody is a roommate and they live in the home and
well,
you know,
exactly. A step-parent.
Sure.
I mean, because if it was that simple, mm-hmm. there would be a lot of unnecessary laws here.
Of course.
Correct?
Of course.
So how would you explain that? I mean, we have to read it in context of the whole area of who is a parent.
Yeah.
How would you fit that in within that context?
Sure. I think the answer is even kind of more broadly, Your Honor, and the answer is that Minnesota does not have a bright line rule that biology is the only way to establish parentage. It simply doesn't. That's
well, but on the other hand, yeah. Minnesota doesn't have any case law, I mean, any law that says just by virtue of the fact you live with someone and act like a parent mm-hmm. while you live with them, mm-hmm. that is in and of itself is enough to establish you as a parent under the law. Isn't that a fair statement?
I would disagree respectfully, and the reason...
Why isn't it not?
And I would disagree because Section 257.71 explicitly identifies in its title an action to declare a mother-child relationship and then refers to the sections within the Parentage Act that would include the holding out presumption.
Well, can I ask you about this? Because this
sure.
is another thing that bothered me because we've had adoption cases that have come up where the father has come up at, you know, the father has failed to follow the law in registering in a timely manner. In fact, we've got a case at the Supreme Court it's not that recent, but the Heinrecker case, where the dad, who was the biological father, was one day late filing for the adoption, or filing with the adoption registry. And in that case, his parental rights were the adoptive parents were allowed to proceed with the adoption because he did not exercise those rights. When you mention this 257.71, I mean, I think, how do you read that statute in the context of the law regarding the requirements of an unmarried father?
Certainly, Your Honor. One, I would identify that they're disparate legal situations. The purpose of the putative father's registry is to provide some certainty when you are working to place a child in an adoptive setting. And the courts and the laws have to place a burden somewhere to determine when is the adoption going to move forward, hence the father's registry. That's why the father's registry is in existence. And that's why the burden is placed on the individual, in that case an unmarried man, to register on the father's registry.
But why wouldn't the unmarried putative mother also have the same obligations? I guess that's what I'm trying to
Certainly.
Work out in my mind. Because I think we have to read all these statutes in context, and I think what we need from you is how would we do that?
Well, you wouldn't be terminating any rights within this case, which is what you're dealing with in an adoptive case. Hence the sort of drastic bright line argument with regard to the father's registry. Here we are not terminating respondents' rights. We're not placing the child for adoption. We're actually moving.
Well, I understand that, but she wants to claim these rights, and yet under your scenario, she's not required to do so within the same timelines as the fathers are required to do.
I would disagree in this situation, Your Honor. And the reason I would disagree is there are no timelines applicable to either a man or a woman in this situation. The holding out provisions don't have a timeline inherent to it, whereas the father's registry does have timelines that have been established. So I don't think these situations are applicable. I'd also identify that in this particular situation, as I did start with the facts, and I'm even going to take one step back, I know there's a lot of law to cover here. The parties began establishing the connection with my client even pre-birth, when they selected a donor to match her physical characteristics, her ethnic characteristics, her eye color, her hair color, her height. The intention of the parties in this case was to create a family, and to create a family together.
Well, so, and I understand all of that. And as I indicated, the facts here are compelling. But again, we're required as a mere error-correcting court
sure.
to just apply the law
sure.
as it is written.
Can I take a
yeah.
slightly different tack? Just
certainly,
you
know, Your Honor.
There's so much, and you're running short on time, Mr. DeWalt. But if we focus, as you started, on 257.55, the presumption of paternity, and you know, as Judge Hooten has pointed out, it's all phrased in the presumption of, you know, a person is presumed to be the biological father if, and then there are these various clauses. And you're focused on 2D, which is the one where he holds out
Correct.
The child as his biological child. But I struggle to see how this applies. I mean, if you even set aside the fact that it's dealing with the biological father, not the mother, I mean, clearly there's no... and then this is just a presumption, which can be rebutted. But what is the point of that section when it's conceded she is not the biological parent?
The point is to establish a parental relationship beyond biology, Your Honor. That's simply the purpose. That is the entire purpose.
Well, how does that fit in this particular section, though?
257.71 is almost a mirror image of section 257.55, which establishes a father and child relationship. These two provisions actually are corollaries of each other. You have a section talking about establishment of a father's rights as a legal parent, and you have a section that in many ways is almost a mirror image of that section talking about the establishment of a mother's rights as a parent. And I would also direct the court again back to 257.54, subpart A. If the legislature intended solely to identify a maternal parental figure through biology and proof of birth alone, that part would have ended before the or, Your Honors. That part would have ended before the or. The fact that that part goes on beyond proof of birth, proof of biology, or establishment of parentage through these other factors is a clear indication. And the only thing that I'm identifying and directing the court to when we're talking about error correcting, 257.71 is actually very clear in its language. It might not be comfortable, and I had this conversation with the district court, it might not be comfortable. It might not be what we might think going in, but when you look at that section in comparison to how to establish the rights of a father, they are actually corollaries. They are actually almost, in many ways, mirror sections to each other. And given that, that's a clear indication by the legislature that there was an intention to create a legal relationship between a parent and a mother, obviously in an unusual situation, by virtue of application of the Parentage Act, including the holding out presumption. That's a plain reading of that statute. That's a plain reading of that statute. I see that I'm almost out of time. And so if the court allows me, I'm just going to shift into, again, as I identified, the plain language of 257.71 and the facts require a finding that appellant has standing under the holding out provision. And if we talk about the facts, I'll just digress very briefly. I don't think there's any doubt or disagreement that the factual support of this case would provide basis that she has, in fact, met her burden by holding herself out. I'd also identify again that that is consistent with the other provisions of the Parentage Act, including 257.54, subpart A, which I've directed the court to, and a gender-neutral reading of 257.57, which is also required. That is also consistent with the policy intent of the legislature in passing section 517.01.
But the holding out provision in D openly holds the child out as a biological child, not as a parent.
And again, in the cases cited within appellant's brief, Your Honor, has identified that legal parentage is established beyond simply biology.
That's true, but not in subdivision 257.55, subdivision 1D. It doesn't talk about anything other than biological child.
Again, I would also identify that within 257.71, it identifies that the...
No, but you want to talk about the holding out provision. I'm saying that you're not... The holding out provision isn't applicable for you because... No one held out the child as being the biological child.
I think, again, 257.71, which references the holding out provision, identifies to the extent applicable those provisions are to be applied. The holding out provision within our case law has not been interpreted in a way that is synonymous with a biological finding, and in fact, Minnesota, again, has a long history, whether it's through recognition of parentages, whether it's through the marital presumption, of establishing parentage, legal parentage, which is a separate category than biological parentage for individuals. I see I'm out of time, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. DeWalt. Do you have a question?
Can I ask one question? Because you didn't get to it.
I apologize,
really,
Your Honor.
If you don't mind.
No, that's fine.
Okay.
He's got rebuttal, of course.
Okay. But I just want to ask the question about the third-party custodian argument.
Right.
Because I think you make an argument that these are extraordinary circumstances.
And, thank you, Your Honor.
And the judge appeared to be kind of wavering on that, but in reviewing the case law indicated that he felt compelled to rule against you on that issue because
correct.
Of the case, our Supreme Court cases. How would you respond to that? Because I think that's a very important issue for you.
Certainly, Your Honor, and I appreciate the additional time from the court. The interpretation respondent has put forward for our third-party custody case law with regard to extraordinary circumstances is simply incorrect. When the court looks at the cases of In re Caiaseth and ALR, what it sees is that both of those cases have explored what does extraordinary circumstances mean. The Caiaseth case identifies that extraordinary circumstances means that an individual who is petitioning for third-party custody must show, at least at a minimum, that they have a pre-existing relationship with the child they are seeking custody of prior to the petition. In Caiaseth, if I recall, and I hope I don't get my cases mixed up here, but I believe in Caiaseth it was cousins seeking to establish custody when they didn't have a prior relationship. So Caiaseth says if you want to, extraordinary circumstances has to mean something. At a minimum, it means an established relationship prior to the petition. And then ALR identifies that I think it was between grandparents and a biological mother, that in that situation, a individual who is an undocumented immigrant, that doesn't qualify as an endangerment or a showing of endangerment, and that for a extraordinary circumstances standard to be met, it must at a minimum implicate grave and weighty concerns. And just to conclude that point, and I know I'm using more time than I was allotted, so I'll try to be brief. The argument being put forward by respondent is that actually sections A, B, and C of that statute, 257C, are almost synonymous. You have to show abandonment, you have to show endangerment, and extraordinary circumstances, you have to show some form of abandonment or endangerment. And it attempts to, I think the word used was gloss over, that, you know, provide a gloss of endangerment to anything with an extraordinary circumstance, which again, I'm just going to come back to pure statutory construction. That is not the intent of the language. And I would identify these are always unusual cases for the most part. Third-party custody cases almost always are unusual. unusual, involving unusual facts. And the intent of the legislature would be to try to encapsulate all the cases that might be out there that they can't possibly predict by allowing discretion to find extraordinary circumstances. And so I will conclude the same way I did at the district court, that if this case doesn't show extraordinary circumstances on a third-party custody level, I really don't know what does. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Dwell.
Thank you.
Counsel for a respondent.
May it please the court, good morning, Your Honors, and Mr. Dwalt. Gary Diebele here on behalf of respondent Linda Vetter. I want to be crystal clear at the outset. We are talking here today about legal parentage. We are not talking about custody. We are not talking about visitation. We are not talking about parenting time. Legal parentage is perhaps the most fundamental legal relationship in our society. It is what establishes legal parentage between a parent and a child. Parent rights and responsibilities flow from that status. Children's rights and the duty to care for the children flow from that as well. And it is something that has always been a legally established relationship, maybe presumed based on marital status of the parties, but it is based on our Parentage Act, which goes back to 1980, on biology or adoption or a marital presumption. And what that means is that we have rules and procedures to follow when we establish this important, basic, bedrock relationship in our society. And parentage has not been a static concept over time. If you go back to medieval times, ecclesiastical courts established parentage. Then as society evolved, it became common law established parentage. And then the latest permutation would be statutory construction. Now it is basically a creature of statute in Minnesota and in most states. And so you have to start, as the court indicated in its questioning of Mr. DeWalt and its analysis, we have to look at the statute. We have to parse the statute, and we have to be mindful of the whole statute, as Judge Hooten said, but we also have to be thinking a little bit about the history of this statute and where it came from. Minnesota statute, as I said, was enacted in 1980, and it was based on the very first Uniform Parentage Act put out by the National NCUSL, the group that does our uniform laws. Minnesota, unlike many other states, basically adopted that first version in 1973 and has pretty much stuck to it. There have been at least three other rewrites of the Uniform Parentage Act. We've kept the original one, and we've added tweaks here and there to make it sort of unique to Minnesota, but we are still basically tied into that initial view of parentage, which is why we see the focus on biology, adoption, and the marital presumption as to how we create a parent-child legal custody relationship in Minnesota. And basically, as I read what the appellant is wanting to do, and I think this comports with what Referee Hutchison did at the trial court level, is they're really kind of pushing a rather novel and somewhat really out there on the cutting edge theory of parentage and how we establish it. What they want to do is adopt a functional view of parentage, or perhaps you could call it an intentional view of parentage. They're kind of two sides of the same coin, function or intent, as a way to create parentage. Those concepts are not in our Parentage Act as it is currently written. Now, there are a handful of states, and Mr. DeWalt cites these in the brief, and I've distinguished them and analyzed them, where probably four or five states have said, we're going to go down that path as a court, an appellate court, and rewrite our parentage law to allow for functional or intentional parentage.
But in these cases, I mean, even in the case involving a father who wants to adopt, one of the factors that the court looks at is whether that person has played some part or some role in that child's life.
Oh, definitely.
That's always a consideration.
Oh, yes.
In this case, there's no issue of fact that the appellant here has played a very significant role in these children's lives.
Well, and I think Mr. DeWalt makes that argument by citing to the two famous U.S. Supreme Court cases that talk about fathers having to step up and do something. There's Stanley versus Illinois, and I forget the other one, but there were two of them that came down in the 70s. And basically they say, you don't just get to come in and say, I get to be the father now because of my role or my status. You've got to show, number one, that you've got a biological connection. That was at play in those cases. And then number two, it's beyond biology. You have to show that you've stepped up and done something. And what we have in this case, unfortunately, is we've had the putative parent stepping up and doing something, and we don't dispute you know, any of the facts that Mr. DeWalt cited, yeah, she did all of this stuff. But she didn't. She doesn't meet the criteria for the statute.
Well, let me ask you this, because, and I'd like to skip right to a third party.
Oh, okay.
Why? I mean, the appellant argues that number one, if you look at the statute, if you read C, which is the extraordinary circumstances, to basically be the same thing as A and B. It's basically reading it as superfluous. I mean, why wouldn't this case fall under the extraordinary circumstances?
A couple of points I want to. First, I want to preface again, going back to my initial comment. Remember, 257C third-party custody is custody. It's not parentage. So had the court granted that part of her motion, she would have custody rights, just like a parent in a divorce case might have. It's not all the rights of parentage. She doesn't go on the birth certificate. She doesn't have all of those rights. So that statute is indeed one of the ways that people in Ms. Bishop's situation would try to establish some kind of rights as to being involved in this child's life in some form or another. And unfortunately, the way that statute is written, it creates difficulties for the same-sex community because, you know, Referee Hutchison went through the two prongs of 257C to get into it. You either are a de facto parent or you're an interested third party. She clearly didn't meet the de facto criteria because my client was living there. The parent has to be out of there and the third party there alone caretaking the child. That then puts you into the three factors, Judge Hooten, that you're talking about. And it basically, because that statute, I remember I was involved in drafting that statute, and it came down, interestingly enough, around the same time that the Troxell case came down. Troxell was in 2000, and this case, the statute was enacted in 2002. And so we very carefully had to do a delicate balance of how do we protect the fundamental constitutional right of a parent in those cases with giving these important third-party caregivers some kind of legal status of some sort. And so a couple of things were done. We put in the criteria, which has really followed Minnesota common law. This was not new. You either have to show endangerment, abandonment. Those are pretty obvious and easy. We don't have either of those here. And then we put in the extraordinary circumstances, kind of the catch-all. For a long time, my own view of that extraordinary circumstances tied because it went back to the NAK case by the Supreme Court. They talked about special needs of the child. If the child had extraordinary special needs that could not be met by a biological parent, that would be a basis if a third party were providing those needs and caring for that child. But then this court, in a published decision, and this is the one that Referee Hutchison hangs his hat on, and I turned to as well in my brief, it's In Re the Custody of ALR, which came down in 2013, and that was the first appellate decision published again that added some further interpretation of what does extraordinary circumstances mean. Is it as open-ended as Mr. DeWalt would argue that, well, any kind of a circumstance where you've got some compelling facts and it would be a, you know, a hardship on the non-biological parent or to get, but here what they basically said was we have to go back to the purpose of third-party custody is you really have to have an unfit parent at the bottom line. Otherwise, we don't go in and you know, divest legal parents of their right to determine who has access to their children. There has to be a real showing.
Well, I know the appellant's arguing that this ALR case is distinguishable. I mean, it's certainly not this situation. And I think what's quoted in the case is that extraordinary circumstances contemplating the statute refers to circumstances of a grave and weighty nature.
Right.
Which encompasses situations when a child has been abused or neglected, as well as circumstances when the child has special needs. And here's the dilemma I'm having with that is that I don't know, is that a limitation to only circumstances of abuse and neglect where that's kind of covered in A and B?
Right.
Or is this saying this is just some examples of what could constitute extraordinary circumstances?
My suspicion, Your Honor, is that language of grave and weighty circumstances, it's got a long history in the appellate case law. It goes back to the Durkin versus Hinnich case. It goes back to some of those early cases before we had a third-party custody statute where it was common law-based. And again, it was trying to balance the rights of the legal parent against this third party. And they said you really need to almost show like an endangerment showing under a child protection case in order to have standing.
But the grave and weighty nature, I know it's been used in termination cases.
Oh, yeah.
and to terminate parental rights because of something they did. But in this case, I mean, the appellant is arguing, well, my rights are basically, or whatever rights I had, would be terminated as a parent. Would that not be grave and weighty?
I don't, well.
Under these unusual circumstances?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And my argument would be is that, you know, again, the third-party custody is a rather extraordinary type of remedy or relief in these circumstances. Again, we have to look at our U.S. Constitution. We have to look at the rights of a parent. And you have to look at all the situations where you might have some third party who means well and has a real big role in the child's life comes in and challenges a legal parent for status and basically control of the rearing of that child. And I think the purpose behind the statute, the purpose behind the case law and all these doctrines we've been talking about is to make that a high burden. And we haven't had a case, maybe this will be the first case, I don't know, where we look at, you know, what are the options for somebody in Ms. Bischoff's situation. And by the way, this sort of goes back to the bigger parentage argument too here. You know, Ms. Bischoff was not without a recourse early on in this relationship to get parentage established. I mean, let us not forget that the predicament that she finds herself in now was in some sense self-generated. Both Mr. DeWalt and I are licensed in Wisconsin, and we had this debate when we were trying this case. We've been doing same-sex adoptions in Minnesota for years and years and years, and my understanding is Wisconsin maybe not as long as we've been doing it, but they did it too. Wisconsin has also recognized assisted reproduction. ARTS is what the acronym that those of us who do family formation call it. There's a bit of a conflation by the amicus in particular in this case by saying this is an ARTS case. This whole situation is an ARTS case, and what the amicus, I think, were upset about is they didn't want people in a traditional ARTS arrangement to be precluded from having parentage established. In my humble opinion, this is not an ARTS case. Ms. Bischoff never entered into any contracts with Ms. Vetter. They never did any of the stuff that goes into it. When intended parents in an ARTS arrangement are planning a parentage arrangement, they have contracts, they have meetings with doctors, they're signing documents, they're planning how are we going to get legal parentage established, and they work on it from day one before the child is even conceived. Nobody is taking away that process or procedure. I do that kind of work all the time. But this was a case where these parties went ahead and had these discussions back and forth. Ms. Bischoff could have decided to carry these children had she wanted to. She decided not to for all the reasons that, you know, the record didn't developed a little bit. She could have done an adoption. They could have gone off. There were same-sex marriages happening at the time these children were born. They could have gone to Canada. They could have gone to other states. And they would have had an argument to make in a Wisconsin court that, look, we're a married couple. We should have parentage established. None of this happened. Ms. Bischoff had a guardianship order as to the oldest child, and facts are a little bit disputed. Our position was she let it lapse. And so she had opportunities to step forward, and then to come along 5 years after the relationship fell apart and make these demands. And by the way, the concern of my client, unlike what the amicus stated in their brief, was not the jilted former lover that she's off with a new girlfriend. My client's concern was, what happens if I die? I don't have great confidence in my former partner's ability to parent these children, and I want to be able to designate who their guardian would be in my estate planning. That is what set this litigation in motion, and that's a legitimate concern by a legal parent raising any child. I want to plan for the future of my child and make sure. We had a whole laundry list of her concerns about Ms. Bischoff's parenting. The judge didn't agree with my client's concern and said, well, it wasn't really justified, but that was her concern. And that's where we go. And I think where we're at now in Minnesota with regard to the state of parentage law, we are on the verge of having to deal with this issue. Thankfully, I think these kinds of cases are going to be less and less common, because now with Obergefell and the nationwide allowing same-sex couples to marry, most people in these parties' positions will now be married at the time conception occurs, and they will come in under the presumption for marriage. Or if they don't do that, they will, you know, they'll find other ways to do it. They'll do an ARTS contract. They'll do it the proper way there and go through all the process and have declaratory judgment as to parentage. We do that all the time in Minnesota. But this is a unique case, perhaps a bit of a historic relic that we're not going to see as many of these anymore. You know, one of the cases I attached, this was the closest we could come in Minnesota to a case or another court that addressed this, was then referee Piper, now Judge Piper's decision in Hennepin County. Facts are nearly identical to this. He addressed the same issues, Judge Wooten, you asked about, all of you commented on the biological component of that holding out. You know, that's what the law says. We may not like it. There's a Uniform Parentage Act work group that I'm on right now, and we're looking to enact the 2017 version. Well, guess what? It's in my appendix. Look at what the recommendation is for 2017. The NACUSL people know exactly what this issue is, and they say there's lots of problems with the argument that's being made by Mr. DeWalt and his client. We want to fix that with the statute. The statute now lays out who can bring one of these actions. It's functional parentage. And addresses Referee Hutchison's concern. Remember in his order, he says, well, so we've got a step-parent that's living there and the couple separates. Can the county go after him for child support and make him a parent over his objection because he held out this child as his own child? What if it was a domestic abuse relationship? Are we going to force, can that guy say, I'm going to be a parent because I held this child out, even though I have no biological connection? I functioned as a parent. It's fraught with a lot of difficult issues, and I don't think it should be something that an appellate court should be trying to fix. You're going to spend a lot of time coming up with a very carefully tailored order that's going to address all of these issues that the UPA 2017 addresses. This really belongs in the legislature, and my hope is that the UPA work group will be able to get that. I like the UPA 2017, by the way. It finally would address assisted reproduction, which we have no laws in Minnesota addressing that. It's got a whole section on that. It's got a whole section on functional parentage, and if you're going to do functional parentage, here's how you do it. So I think that's rather telling that we've got the law as it is right now. I think Referee Hutchison was spot on in terms of his analysis of that. It dovetailed with what Referee Piper said, I don't know, 10 years ago, and the law hasn't changed. It's the exact same statute that we've got. And other states have grappled with it. I mean, Minnesota is not alone. If we're going to look at other jurisdictions, I would ask the court to pay careful attention to that Pennsylvania Supreme Court case that I attached an excerpt from in my appendix, because Pennsylvania has the exact same version of the Parentage Act that we have. They have the 2000 or the 1973 version, and theirs is focused on the marital presumption or biology and adoption. And they reached the same result that Referee Hutchison did. So I'm asking Your Honors to look at this and say, yes, it's a problem. We've got great sympathy for where this family finds itself in. But the law is the law. It's a bedrock concept that we shouldn't just be ignoring and saying, well, we can fix it with this. I mean, we really need the legislature to step in and fix it. And until that happens, this is the correct outcome. Ms. Bishop has visitation rights. She's not being cut out from these children, but we have to recognize what her legal status is under our law as it currently stands. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DeBerry. Would you like rebuttal, Mr. DeWalt?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Very briefly, I would begin by directing the court back to the case in the matter of the welfare of CMG, where it's noted that the Parentage Act was adopted in 1980. It was assumed the effort was to find a biological father and then adjudicate that person the legal father. The precision with which the biological father can now be identified and the recognition of other considerations has since made that search something more than a search for a biological father. This is demonstrated by the fact that when the legislature added the presumption established under the genetic test presumption, it did not make that presumptive or conclusive, but rather simply treated it as the sixth presumption. Thus, though policy and logic may originally have been directed at how to measure the likelihood of biological parenthood, it now has a different objective. The point of that, Your Honors, is, again, there are multiple ways for this state to establish non-biological parentage. Recognition of parentage, marital presumptions, identification on a birth certificate, and the holding out presumption. The holding out presumption, and I've thought about your question, Your Honor, and I apologize for not responding more effectively when it was asked. I do believe that the intent of the holding out presumption is that you hold yourself out as a biological parent without being the biological parent. That is the point of the holding out presumption. If the point of the holding out presumption was simply a statement of biology, there wouldn't be a holding out presumption to begin with. If the individual had a biological relationship, they wouldn't need that factor. I'd also identify that because of the multiple ways that other individuals outside of my client have to establish legal parentage in this state without a biological connection, this court and the district court committed error, and I apologize by stating this court, but the district court committed error when it failed to find that that interpretation was unconstitutional. Because at that point in time, what we have created are two different sets of children. We have created children who can have legal parents that are not biologically related through either a holding out presumption if they're a man, through a marital presumption if they're married, but not in my client's situation where she has a same-sex relationship without a biological connection, but in all other facets has acted as a parent. So going beyond the statutory language brings us into the constitutional considerations of creating different classes and disparate outcomes for children, which is exactly what is happening here. The district court treats the appellant, the party's children, differently than other children of non-biological parents. Again, if she was an unmarried male, she would have access to legal standing by the holding out presumption. If she was non-biological parent married to, in a same-sex or heterosexual marriage, she would have access to the legal standing through the marital presumption. Again, there's numerous ways for non-biological parents, legal parents, to be established in this state that will have a disparate effect on my client if that is not found. So,
can I ask you one question?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Mr. Daigle raised this issue. If we adopt your interpretation of the statutes, couldn't it be also utilized by the biological mother to basically seek child support against the partner who lived with her at some point?
I think there's actually that case is wending its way through the state. I think it came out of one of the northern counties. I don't recall offhand, Your Honor, where I think it was used for that exact purpose. The argument was made in reverse that an individual who intended to form a family and then the non-biological parent says, nope, I want to be out. I don't want to, you know, bargain for too much. And the biological parent says, no, not so fast. And the...
Was that a case where where there was an adoption or...
No. To my understanding, I apologize, and I don't mean to speak to cases that I'm not overly familiar with, but my understanding is that was not an adoptive case. It actually was specifically the question the court just asked, which was the biological parent seeking to pursue child support against the non-custodial parent. I believe it's actually come up to Court of Appeals and been remanded back to the district court on not on the merits, on other grounds, and where it's at this moment, I don't know. But, yeah, certainly if... parentage means anything, it means the responsibilities do come with the rights, Your Honor, and my client certainly understands that. Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. DeWald. Thank you, Mr. Deeley. Very well briefed and argued. We appreciate it. Our schedule this morning has two interactive video cases on it following this argument, and so we have to recess for a period of time to get that set up. So we're currently in recess.
Thank you, Your Honor.